Chapter number 64, Public Revenue. Page number 782. A modern state taps a number of sources to collect its revenue. Broadly speaking, the government revenues can be classified as 1. Tax revenue and 2. Non-tax revenue. Tax revenue is derived from various taxes. A. Direct taxes, example, income tax, wealth tax, gift tax, expenditure tax, etc. B. Indirect taxes, example, custom duties, excise duties, sales tax, etc. Non-tax revenue is derived from public undertakings called prices and other miscellaneous receipts. It also raises loans, short-term and long-term, to augment its revenues. The major sources of revenue are taxes and prices. The minor sources are fees, special assessment, fines, forfeitures, escheats, tributes and indemnities, gifts and grants. Taxes. As we have mentioned above, that the most important source of public revenue is taxation. But taxation revenue takes several forms. It consists of taxes, fees, prices, special assessments, rates, etc. Let us distinguish between all these forms. Tax. Plehin defines taxes thus. Taxes are generally compulsory contributions of wealth levied upon persons, natural or corporate, to defray the expenses incurred in conferring common benefit upon the residents of the state.
Reference note: Introduction to Public Finance, 1921, p. 59.
This definition brings out the true nature of tax. The essence of a tax is A. That it is a compulsory levy under certain conditions, and B. It is meant for the general purpose of the state. The individual cannot expect that the state should render him a specific service in return for the tax paid by him. If I pay income tax, I cannot claim in return that the state should post a policeman at my gate during night to protect my property, which is a source of income to me. This, however, does not mean that the state undertakes to do nothing in return for the taxes that it receives from the people. The state carries on the general administration and confers lots of benefit on the community. But these are common benefits meant for all and not any specific benefit meant for a particular taxpayer. There is no direct quid pro quo. The taxes are intended to meet the general expenses of the government, which confer a common benefit. In the words of Taussig, the essence of a tax, as distinguished from other charges by the government, is the absence of any direct quid pro quo between the taxpayer and the public authority.
Reference note: Principles of Economics, Chapter 66, Roman number 1.
Price. In modern times, public sector occupies a very important place in the economy. We find public enterprises being run side by side with private enterprises. The government has to launch public enterprises when private sector is either unwilling or unable to enter certain fields because the return is either uncertain or it takes a long time to mature, such as multipurpose projects, railways, hydroelectric works, water works, huge iron and steel works. Page number 783. The government does not supply these services or goods manufactured in government undertakings free, but charges a price. When public authority sells a commodity or renders a service, the charge made on the consumer who avails of the service or buys a commodity is called a price. The income from the public enterprises now constitutes a substantial source of revenue. Fee. It is also a compulsory payment made by those who obtain a certain service, who obtain a definite service in return. The fee is intended to cover a part of the cost of the service rendered. It is never more than the cost of service. Also, some public purpose is kept in view in the service rendered. The obvious example is of the educational fees. In the words of Plehin, a fee may be defined as a compulsory contribution of wealth made by a person, natural or corporate, under the authority of public power to defray a part or all of the expenses involved in some action of the government, which, while creating a common benefit, also confers a special benefit, or one that is arbitrarily so regarded. In short, a fee is charged for a specific service which is rendered primarily in public interest. A license fee, however, is much more than the cost of service, and there is not much of a positive service in return. The difference between a fee and a price is that in a fee, the public interest is prominent, whereas a price is a payment for a service of business character, example, charges for travelling on state railways. You can escape the price by not purchasing a service. Price also differs from a tax. A tax is paid for a common benefit, whereas both fees and prices are paid for specific benefits. Special assessment is defined by Professor Seligman as a compulsory contribution levied in proportion to the special benefit derived to defray the cost of the special improvement to property undertaken in the public interest. Suppose a government builds a road or makes suitable drainage arrangements, all the property in the neighborhood will appreciate in value. The state has a right to appropriate a part of this unearned increment. Special assessment is compulsory like a tax. But the tax imposed for a special purpose is called special assessment. These assessments are intended to cover a part of the extraordinary expenditure incurred by the public authority in this connection. They are levied on property proportionately to the benefit conferred. Seligman analyzes the essence of a special assessment thus. A. There is the element of special purpose. B. The specific benefit is measurable. C. These assessments are not progressive but proportional to the benefit received. D. They are for specific local improvements. And E. They are intended to extend and improve, as it were, the permanent plant of the community. Unlike a fee, there is an element of coercion in special assessment. Rates. Rates are levied by local bodies, that is, municipalities and district boards, for local purposes. They are generally levied on immovable property of the residents, but not necessarily for any special improvements effected or special benefits conferred. The rates generally vary from locality to locality. Fines. Fines are imposed as a penalty for breaking the law. A fine is compulsory like a tax, but it is imposed more as a deterrent than as a source of revenue. Forfeitures. If an under-trial jumps a bail, or a party to contract fails to carry his part of the contract, the money deposited is forfeited. The money so forfeited goes to the state. It is, however, a minor source. Escheat. When a person dies heirless, or without a successor, or leaves no will behind, his property or assets will go to the state. This claim of the state to a deceased assets is called escheat. Tributes and indemnities. These are paid by foreign countries. Tributes are paid by conquered countries and indemnities for any damage done to the country, either by war of aggression or otherwise. Page number 784. Grants and gifts. Grants are given by government at a higher level to that at the lower level. Example, from the central government to the state government, or from the state government to a district board, municipality or a corporation. These are given for a specific purpose, example, for economic development or some public works, or for public health or education. Gifts are received either from the governments of some private bodies or individuals. Gifts are sometimes received from foreign governments for relief in natural calamities like earthquake, floods, droughts, cyclones, etc. Donations are given by individuals for specific purposes such as building a hospital or relief fund. Classification of taxes. Taxes have been variously classified. Some classifications are given below. Taxes may be proportional, progressive, regressive, and degressive. Proportional tax. A proportional tax is one in which whatever the size of income, the same rate or same percentage is charged. If all the taxpayers have to pay, say, 1% of their income as tax, it is a case of proportional taxation. The same percentage is charged from all the taxpayers. Progressive tax. If, on the other hand, the rate of the tax rises as the taxable income increases, the tax is called a progressive tax. The principle of a progressive tax is higher the income, higher the rate. It is worth noting that even under proportional tax, the richer man pays more. For example, if the rate is 1% on the monthly salary, a man who is getting rupees 500 per month will pay rupees 60 per year, and the man who is getting rupees 600 per month will pay rupees 72 per year. Thus, the man with a higher income pays more, even under the proportional taxation. But under progressive taxation, he will pay much more because, as the income increases, the rate of the tax must also increase. The man with rupees 600 monthly salary may have to pay 2% instead of 1%. He will pay, therefore, rupees 120 instead of rupees 60 per year. All countries have adopted the progressive system of taxation as it is considered more equitable. This is due to the fact that the sacrifice entailed in proportional taxation is less than it ought to be. We shall consider the pros and cons of progressive taxation in a subsequent section. Regressive tax. A tax is said to be regressive when its burden falls more heavily on the poor than the rich. It is the opposite of a progressive tax. No civilized government imposes a tax in which, as the income increases, the rate of tax is lowered. That would be palpably unjust. But there are several taxes on commodities whose burden rests mainly on the poor. The Indian salt tax was regarded as a regressive tax as it pressed more heavily on the poor than on the rich. As a matter of fact, the rich man did not feel it at all. Degressive tax. A tax is called degressive when the higher incomes do not make a due sacrifice or when the burden imposed on them is relatively less. This will happen when a tax is only mildly progressive, that is, when the rate of progression is not sufficiently steep. A tax may be progressive up to a certain limit beyond which a uniform rate is charged. In that case, there will be a lower relative sacrifice on the larger incomes than on smaller incomes. There is a table which has four columns. The first column is types of taxes. The second column is income of 1 lakh. The third column is income of 2 lakhs. And the fourth column is an income of 3 lakhs. The progressive rate of tax for the income of 1 lakh is 10%. The regressive rate of tax is 20%. And the proportional rate of tax is 10%. For an income of 1 lakh, the progressive rate of tax is 10%, the regressive rate of tax is plus 20%, and the proportional rate of tax is 10%. For an income of 2 lakhs, The progressive rate of tax is 18%, the regressive rate of tax is 12%, and the proportional rate of tax is 10%. For an income of 3 lakhs, the progressive rate of tax is 30%, the regressive rate of tax is 5%, and the proportional rate of tax is 10%. Page number 785. In the above diagram on vertical axis, the marginal rate of tax is measured, and in the horizontal axis, the size of income is measured. A is progressive taxes, which shows an upward rising line. B is regressive taxes, which gives a downward moving line. C is proportional taxes line, which is horizontal to x-axis. D is degressive taxes, which rises slowly, but after reaching a point, it becomes horizontal to x-axis. The comparison of direct and indirect taxes from imposition of burden point of view. It is said that direct taxes imposes lesser burden compared to the indirect taxes. This is due to the reason that direct taxes are paid directly by the taxpayer to the government, whereas indirect taxes are paid through middlemen. Hence, the middlemen exploit the taxpayers. In the above diagram, y-axis the income is measured, whereas on x-axis the quantity of goods is measured. 1. AB is the budget line, and IC3 is tangent to it at point A. In OA amount of income, the consumer is able to get OB amount of goods. As the consumer is high on higher indifference curve, he is getting more satisfaction compared to when he pays taxes. 2. MN is the new budget line, as AM amount of money is taken away from the consumer by the government by means of direct taxes. Due to this, he is on IC2. By means of this, he is getting ON amount of goods. 3. AD budget line is due to the imposition of indirect taxes. The consumer is on IC3 and getting OD amount of goods. Though the government is imposing or getting the same amount of revenue, whether by direct taxes or indirect taxes, that is, AM amount, which is equal to KH. Before taxes, the consumer is on IC3 and getting OB amount of goods. After direct taxes, the consumer is on IC2 and getting ON amount of goods. After indirect taxes, the consumer is on IC1 and getting OD amount of goods. After indirect taxes, the consumer is on IC1 and getting OD amount of goods. OB is greater than ON, which is greater than OD. It is clear that indirect taxes gives lesser amount of goods than direct taxes. It is clear that indirect taxes gives lesser amount of goods than direct taxes. DN amount of less goods are obtained by the consumer due to indirect taxes, though the government receives the same amount of taxes, that is, AM equals KH. This is referred to as the exploitation of the consumer by the middleman, or the indirect taxes puts more burden on the consumers than direct taxes. Direct and indirect taxes. Another classification of taxes is as direct taxes and indirect taxes. In the case of a direct tax, the man who pays it also intends to bear it. In the case of a direct tax, the man who pays it is also intended to bear it. But an indirect tax is expected to be shifted to other persons. If I pay income tax, I have to bear it. I cannot pass it on to somebody else. It is a direct tax. But if a tax is imposed on sugar, the dealer who first pays it charges it from the next buyer till ultimately it is borne by the consumers of sugar. The tax has been shifted. It is called an indirect tax. In the case of direct taxes, as Mrs. Hicks explains, the liability varies with the circumstances of the taxpayer, and the relation between the taxpayer and the revenue authorities is direct and personal. Page number 786. But in the case of indirect taxes, the liability depends on the amount or value of a particular product or service bought. Here, there is an indirect relation between the taxpayer and the revenue authorities. For the taxes are collected unofficially through the agency of merchants. Direct taxes are taxes on income and indirect taxes are taxes on outlay. We shall discuss the merits and demerits of direct and indirect taxes in a later chapter. Chapter number 64. Specific and ad valorem taxes. Taxes may also be classified as specific and ad valorem taxes. A specific tax is according to the weight of the commodity. An ad valorem tax is according to its value. If imposed on coarser or cheaper articles, the specific duties mean a heavier burden and are considered regressive in nature. But they are simpler to administer. For the administration of ad valorem duties, an elaborate administrative machinery is needed. The invoice has to be checked and a host of appraisers needed for evaluating the goods. Canons of taxation. Adam Smith's canons. Adam Smith's contribution to taxation part of the economic theory is still regarded as classic. His statement of the canons of taxation has hardly been surpassed in clarity and simplicity. Adam Smith's canons still constitute the foundations of all discussions on the principles of taxation. We give below his four celebrated canons. 1. Canon of Equality. The subjects of every state ought to contribute towards the support of the government as nearly as possible in proportion to their respective abilities, that is, in proportion to the revenue which they respectively enjoy under the protection of the state. This canon embodies the principle of equity or justice. This is the most important canon of taxation. It lays the moral foundation of the tax system. The canon of equality does not mean that every taxpayer should pay the same sum. That would be manifestly unjust. Nor does it mean that they should pay at the same rate, which means proportional taxation, and a proportional tax is also not a just tax. What this canon really means is the equality of sacrifice. The amount of the tax paid is to be in proportion to the respective abilities of the taxpayers. This clearly points to progressive taxation. Adam Smith makes this clear in a subsequent portion of his book, Wealth of Nations. He says it is not very unreasonable that the rich should contribute to the public expense not only in proportion to their revenue, but something more than the proportion.
Reference note: The Wealth of Nations, Book 5, Volume 2, p. 327.
Only then the tax will be in proportion to the ability to pay. 2. Canon of Certainty. The tax which each individual is bound to pay ought to be certain and not arbitrary. The time of payment, the manner of payment, the quantity to be paid ought all to be clear and plain to the contributor and to every other person. Where it is otherwise, every person subject to the tax is put more or less in the power of the tax gatherer, who can either aggravate the tax upon any obnoxious contributor or extort, by the terror of such aggravation, some present or prerequisite to himself. Uncertainty in taxation, according to Adam Smith, encourages insolence or corruption. He regards this canon as very important, for, in his view, very considerable degree of inequality is not near so great an evil as a very small degree of uncertainty. Hadley also regards it as the most fundamental canon, for, according to him, all attempts at equality will prove illusory without the taxes being certain. The canon of certainty demands that there should be no element of arbitrariness in a tax. It is not to be left to the caprice or the sweet will of the income tax department. The taxpayer should be able to see for himself why he is called upon to pay a particular sum. That is why wide publicity is given to the budget proposals and discussions thereon. The passing of the budget is a guarantee of certainty. An old tax is no tax is a maxim of taxation which issues out of the canon of certainty. An old tax is well known, its reactions are certain, and the people are supposed to have made the necessary adjustments. The tax is not felt. It causes the least disturbance in the economic arrangements of the taxpayer. There is little inconvenience from an old tax. Certainty is needed not only from the point of view of the taxpayer, but also from that of the state. The government should be able to estimate roughly the proceeds of the various taxes proposed to be levied and the time when they are expected to flow in. Only then the government can follow its financial program. Page number 787. 3. Canon of convenience. Every tax ought to be levied at the time or in the manner in which it is most likely to be convenient for the contributor to pay it. The canon of certainty says that the time and the manner of payment should be certain. But the canon of convenience says that the time of payment and the manner of payment should be convenient. If a tax on land or house is collected at a time when the rent is expected to be paid and acceptable by check, the manner is convenient, but not so if it is to be paid personally to the taxing authority. In the latter case, there will be a lot more inconvenience and harassment. Taxes on consumers are very convenient. The consumer pays them when he makes purchases and at a time when he can afford to pay, because the purchaser chooses his own time for purchasing. The manner is also very convenient, for he has to make no special arrangements for paying a tax. He pays it when he buys the commodity. The tax is wrapped in the price of the community. The Indian land revenue conforms to the canon of convenience, because it is paid in installments, and after the harvest time, the Indian land revenue conforms to the canon of convenience because it is paid in installments and after the harvest time. Income tax, on the other hand, infringes the canon of convenience. The assessee has to take his account books to the income tax officer in order to satisfy him about the accounts. This necessitates a series of personal interviews with the consequent loss of time. It also involves a lot of trouble and oppression. 4. Canon of economy. Every tax ought to be so contributed as both to take out and to keep out of pockets of the people as little as possible over and above what it brings to the public treasury of the state. One implication of the canon of economy is very obvious. The tax is economical if the cost of collecting it is very small. If, on the other hand, the salaries of the officers engaged in collecting the tax take away a big portion of the tax revenue, the tax is certainly uneconomical. As far as possible, as much should come into the state treasury as is taken out of the people's pocket. Nothing should evaporate in the way. If there is corruption or oppression involved in the frequent visits to the income tax office and the odious examination by the taxing officer, the canon of economy is not justified. But the tax should also be economical in another, perhaps broader sense. It would infringe the canon of economy if it is related to the development of trade and industry in any manner. If incomes are subject to a very heavy tax, saving may be discouraged. Capital will not accumulate, and the productive capacity of the community will be seriously impaired. This would obviously be uneconomical. A tax is economical if it does not hamper in any manner the economic progress of the country. Taxes on harmful drugs and intoxicants are regarded as economical because they not only bring income to the state but also discourage unproductive expenditure. But taxes on raw materials are uneconomical because they raise the price of the manufactured goods and weaken the competitive power of the industry. Also, every middleman goes on adding something to the tax that he has paid. The first canon of Adam Smith is ethical and the other three are administrative in character. Other canons. Since Adam Smith wrote, the science of public finance has continued to grow. Subsequent writers have added canons of their own to his four canons. The following are some of those which have been subsequently added. Page number 788. 5. Fiscal adequacy or productivity. The state should be able to function with the revenue raised from the people by means of taxes. The government should be free from financial embarrassments. It will be necessary, therefore, that the tax proceeds should adequately cover the government expenditure and the government does not run into a deficit. But the government should also not err on the side of excess. In their zeal to raise more revenue, they should not cripple in any manner the productive capacity of the community or impair the economic resources of the country. The canon of productivity would indicate that a few taxes bringing a large revenue are better than many taxes each bringing a very small revenue. Too great a multiplicity of taxes is to be avoided, because each tax is likely to cause some vexation to the citizens. But here again we must warn that the principle of concentration should not be carried to excess, otherwise it may become either uneconomical or inequitable. 6. Elasticity. The canon of elasticity is closely connected with that of fiscal adequacy. As the needs of the state increase, the revenue should also increase, otherwise they will cease to be adequate. To meet an emergency or a period of stress and strain, the government should be in a position to augment its financial resources. Some of the taxes should be capable of yielding more if need be. Income tax is a very good example of an elastic tax. By raising the rate a bit or by levying a surcharge, the yield from income tax can be considerably increased. 7. Flexibility. The canon of flexibility looks like that of elasticity, but the difference between the two is quite clear. Flexibility means that there should be no rigidity in the tax system so that it can be quickly adjusted to new conditions, and elasticity means that the revenues can be increased. Unless the system is flexible, the revenue cannot be increased, for alterations will not be possible. Thus, the presence of flexibility is a condition of elasticity. If a tax system cannot be altered without bringing about a revolution, it lacks flexibility. The permanent settlement of Bengal, 1793, is an example of rigidity or lack of flexibility in a tax. Under this arrangement, the government bound itself to collect the same sum from the landowners in perpetuity. The lack of flexibility was in no small measure the cause of the financial troubles of Bengal. 8. Simplicity. In the words of Armitage Smith, a system of taxation should be simple, plain, and intelligible to the common understanding. This canon is essential if corruption or oppression is to be avoided. If a tax is complicated so that the taxpayer cannot understand how much he is to pay and why he is to pay it, a great power will pass into the hands of the tax gatherers. The door will be widely opened to corruption and oppression. 9. Diversity. Another important principle is that of diversity. A single tax or only a few taxes will not do. There should be a large variety of taxes so that all the citizens who can afford to contribute to the state revenue should be made to do so. They should be approached in a variety of ways. There should be a wise admixture of direct and indirect taxes. In this manner, the canons of fiscal adequacy and equity may be better satisfied. But too great a multiplicity will be bad and uneconomical. 10. Achievement of social and economic objectives. Considering the role that taxation is called upon to play in modern times, another principle is being emphasized, that is, the effects of taxation should be compatible with the economic and social objectives that the community has placed before itself, and with the institutions and processes considered essential for the attainment of these objectives. The neutrality principle, or leave them as you find them principle, no longer holds the field. The taxation policy today has to be more positive. It is intended to bring about economic stability and development besides the attainment of other political and social goals. In conjunction with economic controls and monetary measures, taxation has to be freely used to combat threats of economic instability and stagnation by means of a managed compensatory fiscal program. It was Adolf Wagner, a German economist, who in his book Finanzwissenschaft, published in 1880, developed a social compensatory or social political theory of taxation for the purpose of reducing economic inequalities. Page number 789. The application of this theory can be seen during the Depression dilemma of the 30s and during and after the Second World War, when taxation was used as a tool for fighting inflation. Several other considerations have been put forward. It is recommended, for instance, that a tax should fall on revenue and not on capital. It should not cut down the minimum subsistence of the taxpayer, and so on. Social and economic objectives of taxation. Among the social and economic objectives of taxation, the following principal ones may be mentioned. A. Reduction of inequalities in income and wealth. One of the main objectives of taxation is to reduce, if not to remove, inequalities of income and wealth. For this purpose, steeply progressive taxes must be levied on the affluent sections of society. This is the trend in all democratic countries. B. Accelerating economic growth. Another important objective is to accelerate economic growth. For this purpose, the tax system must be so designed as to raise the rates of saving and investment. This is a very important objective for developing economies like India. But in the developed economies, during periods of depression, the aim is to increase consumption and reduce saving so that aggregate demand may increase and remove depression, and the prevailing unemployment may diminish. On the contrary, when there is inflation, the objective of taxation policy is to reduce consumption, that is, to increase saving, so that aggregate demand may diminish and the price rise is checked. C. Price stability. In underdeveloped countries, there is another objective that the tax system has to achieve, that is, price stability to ensure growth with stability. When these countries launch economic development program, they have to face the problem of inflation or soaring prices. They should follow an integrated tax policy to solve this problem. Objectives in a developing economy. A dominant aim of underdeveloped countries is to accelerate economic development. This calls for a rational reorganization of their tax system on the basis of the concept of functional finance. The tax policy of such countries is to be attuned to the raising of resources required for development. In the developed countries, the aim is to ensure economic stability and to avoid economic fluctuations. But the aim in the underdeveloped countries is to ensure rapid economic growth, and taxation is to be used as an instrument of economic progress. Accordingly, the underdeveloped economies must ensure collective savings or raising the ratio of savings to national income through taxation, because in such countries saving is not practiced voluntarily. But mere saving is not enough. The savings must be invested. Thus, the tax policy must strengthen incentives to savings and investment. The traditional canons of taxation developed in the West will not serve the purpose. The underdeveloped countries have to act on different canons. Take the case of the canon of ability to pay. In the realm of theory of taxation, this canon still enjoys pride of place among the canons of taxation. This is favored because it leads to progressive taxation and results in reduction of inequalities. But the question of reduction of inequalities must be taken up separately, keeping in view the requirements of a developing economy. From the point of view of development, taxation is not to be viewed as solely a contribution to meet the costs of common services rendered by the state. It is to be viewed rather as a powerful tool to raise the rate of investment in the economy. The following few canons of taxation may be suggested as more appropriate to a developing economy. 1. Ability to contribute to economic development. Each person should be made to contribute to economic development according to his ability to do so. All his unused capacity must be utilized through appropriate tax measures for the purpose of economic development. Page number 790. Suppose a person is making a large saving, but he lets it lie idle. Such saving must be mobilized and channelized into investment. The compulsory deposit scheme, later replaced by annuity deposit scheme in India, and the cumulative time deposit in post offices promote this purpose. If a person's income exceeds what is required to maintain his efficiency and incentive, that is, willingness and ability to work and save, this excess must be taken away and used for economic development, of course on reasonable compensation. 2. Mobilization of economic surplus. In all backward economies, a significant proportion of national output goes to the big landlords and the other idle rich or propertied people. A large portion of their income is spent on conspicuous consumption, example, building of palaces, etc. This is unproductive expenditure and a waste from the point of national development. Economic growth can be accelerated if an appreciable portion of this surplus income is mobilized and made available for productive investment. Hence, an important canon of taxation in a developing economy is the mobilization of economic surplus generated in the various sectors of the economy. 3. Increasing the incremental saving ratio. As economic development proceeds apace, incomes rise. But there is a danger that propensity to consume may also increase, so that extra incomes generated in the economy are utilized in consumption rather than invested in production. This has to be prevented. In other words, consumption is not to be allowed to increase in proportion to increase in incomes. Thus, taxation must also mobilize any increase in economic surplus accruing to individuals. For achieving this purpose, commodity taxes are quite effective. 4. Income elasticity of taxation. In backward economies, the share of taxation out of the national income is less than 10%. This share must be progressively raised as national income increases as a result of economic development. This needs a built-in flexibility in the tax system. Progressive taxation of incomes provides this flexibility. Taxation of goods having a high income elasticity of demand also imparts to the tax system the much-needed flexibility. 5. Equity. The canon of equity demands that the burden of economic development must be distributed among the different sections of the community equitably. That is why the richer classes are prevented from increasing their consumption in proportion to the rise in their incomes. This is how they make a sacrifice for the economic development of their country. The poor people also make a sacrifice because rising prices curtail their consumption. In this manner, sacrifices in consumption are shared by all the sections of the people. Thus, the burden of economic development is equitably distributed among all. There is what is called the rule of horizontal equity, according to which persons in similar circumstances and with similar economic behavior in terms of utilization of economic surplus accruing to them must be treated alike for the purpose of taxation. These are a few of the principles which must underlie the tax system of a developing economy. Optimum allocation of resources. The tax system should be so framed as to ensure that the productive resources of the economy are optimally allocated and utilized. For this purpose, it is essential that the tax system should be economically neutral. In other words, it should interfere as little as possible with the consumer's choices for consumption goods and the producer's choices regarding the use of factors. The owners of factors should be enabled to seek their most remunerative employment. The price mechanism should be allowed to operate freely so that there is optimum output of goods. Page number 791. It can be understood that the imposition of a tax leads to diversion of resources from the taxed to the non-taxed sector. This reallocation of resources may be a departure from the optimum utilization of resources. Hence, the nature of the taxes and the rate of taxes should be such as to ensure optimum utilization of resources. Above all, the tax system should conform to the principle of maximum social advantage so that the society as a whole is benefited to the maximum extent possible. Conclusion. It may, however, be emphasized in conclusion that no tax system in the world can satisfy all the criteria of a good tax system mentioned above. Some of the objectives conflict with one another, whereas others are complementary. For instance, too high progressiveness in the tax system may reduce inequalities, but they may also reduce national output and employment by damaging productive efficiency. Similarly, protective import duties may promote industrial development, but they may reallocate productive resources in such a manner as to depart from the optimum. The best thing to do is to adapt the tax system to the prevalent economic situation and to make it conform to aims and objectives considered most desirable under the circumstances. Evaluation of the Indian tax system. According to Kaldor, who was invited to report on the Indian tax system, there are three main considerations that should be taken into account in framing an effective tax system. That is, equity, economic effects, and administrative efficiency. From the point of view of equity, the most important consideration is that the tax system should not contain a systematic bias in favor of particular groups of taxpayers and against others. From the point of view of economic effects of taxation, the major consideration is to prevent the tax system from becoming too much of a disincentive on effort, initiative, or enterprise. From the point of view of administrative efficiency, all loopholes for evasion should be plugged, and the main requirements are simplicity and comprehensiveness embracing all forms of beneficial receipts, a single comprehensive return, self-checking system of taxation, and an automatic reporting system. According to Kaldor, the present system of direct taxation in India is, however, both inefficient and inequitable. It is inequitable because the present base of taxation, that is, income, as defined in law, is defective and is capable of being manipulated by certain classes of taxpayers. It is inefficient because of the possibility of large-scale evasion on account of the limited information furnished by taxpayers and on account of the absence of any comprehensive reporting system on property transactions and property income. Kaldor made proposals which aimed at broadening the tax base through the introduction of an annual tax on wealth, a tax on capital gains, a general gift tax, and a personal expenditure tax. All these five taxes were to be assessed simultaneously on the basis of a single comprehensive return, and they are self-checking in character, so that concealment or understatement of income from certain items will involve an added liability with regard to others. He says that it is far better to have a foolproof system of taxation with a moderate rate schedule than a system which has the appearance of high progressivity but which cannot be effectively or impartially administered. Judged from the point of view of economic development, however, the tax effort in India has been quite satisfactory. The ratio of savings to national income has been going up. It has been estimated that 25% of the increase in incomes, that is, marginal savings rate, has been saved, which is quite commendable. The investment has been going up by leaps and bounds, as from 1 5-year plan to another. The second plan outlay was more than double of the first, and the third more than double of the second, and the fourth plan more than the three earlier plans combined. Page number 792. Role of taxation in developing economies. For underdeveloped or developing countries, it is very essential to have an appropriate taxation policy if economic growth is to be accelerated. In the absence of a suitable tax policy, the rate of economic growth is bound to be tardy. In modern times, the aim of public finance is not merely to raise sufficient financial resources for meeting administrative expenses, for maintenance of law and order, and to protect the country from foreign aggression. On the other hand, the sphere of public finance has been very much extended. It is now considered a powerful instrument in the hands of the state for the achievement of important economic and social objectives. The most important objective before these countries is to accelerate their economic growth. The underdeveloped countries like India are caught up in the vicious circle of poverty. Consequently, such countries are not able to save much, whether we consider individual savings or collective savings by corporations and firms. Their annual savings are only a small fraction of their national income. In India, the rate of domestic savings has been projected to grow from 12.2% of GNP in 1973-74 to 15.7% in 1978-79. In the same period, the rate of investment is expected to rise from 13.7% of GNP in 1973-74 to 16.3% of GNP in 1978-79. But our annual rate of growth has been round about 3%. This means that at a much greater tax effort is called for to raise our growth rate to a reasonable level. Since private savings and capital formation are meager in India, the responsibility of resource mobilization for economic growth falls on the state. That is why the role of public finance in developing countries is very important. For accelerating economic growth, the government has to adopt a tax policy which may raise the rates of saving and capital formation in the country. Since private investment is not adequate for the purpose, the government has to make up the deficiency of private investment by increasing public investment and, for that purpose, raise resources through taxation. There are several advantages of increasing savings and investment through taxes. A. Taxation is the only effective weapon by which private consumption can be curbed and thus resources transferred to the state. B. Through taxation, inequalities in income and wealth can be reduced. Since developing countries like India have a mixed economy, care has also to be taken that capital formation and investment in the private sector is not discouraged. The primary objective of tax policy is therefore to promote investment both in the private and public sectors. Taxation policy is to be directed to raising the ratio of savings to national income. Hence, such taxes should be levied to encourage savings and investment. If the people do not make savings out of their increasing incomes, then the government should take away from them a part of their income through taxes, invest it in development programs. In other words, taxes result in forced saving. Tax policy for developing economies. It is natural that tax policy which is appropriate for developed countries may not suit the underdeveloped or developing countries. This is due to several reasons. In other words, taxes result in forced saving. Here is a table depicting gross domestic saving and gross domestic capital formation in the Indian economy. In brackets, rupees in crores at current prices. Column number 1 is gross domestic saving. Column number 2 is net capital inflow. Column number 3 is gross domestic capital formation. In brackets, column number 3 equals column number 1 plus column number 2. In the year 1950-51, the gross domestic saving was rupees 887 crores. In brackets, 8.9% of GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees minus 21 crores. In brackets, minus 0.2% of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 866 crores. In brackets, 8.7% GDP. In the year 1960-61, the gross domestic saving was rupees 1989 crores. In brackets, 11.6% GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 481 crores. In brackets, 2.8% GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 2470 crores. In brackets, 14.4% GDP. In 1970-1971, the gross domestic saving was rupees 6,649 crores. In brackets, 14.6% GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 394 crores. In brackets, 0.8% of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 7,043 crores. In brackets, 15.4% GDP. In 1980-81, the gross domestic saving was rupees 27,136 crores. In brackets, 18.9% GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 2,094 crores. In brackets, 1.4% of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 29,230 crores. In brackets, 20.3% of GDP. In 1990-91, the gross domestic saving was rupees 1,31,340 crores. In brackets, 23.1% of GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 16,196 crores. In brackets, 3.2% of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 1,49,536 crores. In brackets, 26.3% of GDP. In 1995-96, the gross domestic saving was rupees 2,98,747 crores. In brackets, 25.1% of GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 20,780 crores. in brackets 1.8 of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 3,19,527 crores in brackets 26.9% of GDP. In 1999 to 2000, the gross domestic saving was rupees 4,66,640 crores in brackets 24.1% of GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 21,988 crores in brackets 1.1% of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 4,88,628 crores in brackets 25.2% of GDP. In the year 2000 to 2001, the gross domestic saving was rupees 4,91,761 crores in brackets 23.4% of GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 12,977 in brackets 0.6% of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 5,04,738 crores in brackets 24.6% of GDP. In the year 2001 to 2002, the gross domestic saving was rupees 5,49,963 crores in brackets 24.0% of GDP. The net capital inflow was rupees 4,872 crores in brackets minus 0.3% of GDP. The gross domestic capital formation was rupees 5,45,091 crores in brackets 23.7% of GDP. This source is from Central Statistical Organization and Economic Survey of 2002-2003. Page number 793. B. The developed countries pay greater attention in their tax policy to ability to pay or equity. But in the underdeveloped countries, more attention is given to the amount of revenue raised and practicability. C. The governments in developed countries generally pursue the policy of laissez-faire in economic matters. On the other hand, the governments in developing countries have to intervene to make sure that the productive resources are utilized in strategic or key industries and in other essential economic activities. D. Whereas the objective of developed countries is to reduce inequalities in income and wealth, the primary objective of the developing countries is to accelerate economic growth. Hence, underdeveloped countries should not borrow or imitate the tax policies adopted in the developed countries. It does not follow that from the low per capita income of the underdeveloped countries that the rate of savings must also necessarily be low. Even in underdeveloped countries, there are many rich people like big industrialists, big landlords and owners of vast urban property. They enjoy large incomes out of which sizable savings can be made. But since these savings generally seek investment in jewelry and real estate, they are not utilized for economic development. If these economic surpluses are mobilized through taxation and used in productive investment, economic development can be accelerated beyond doubt. If an economy enjoys an economic surplus after satisfying consumption needs, it can be expected to develop economically. Economic surplus is the difference between current output and essential consumption. Some countries waste this surplus in unproductive consumption. Example, Maharajas building palaces. In agriculturally predominant countries, such surpluses go into the hands of big zamindars, Sahukars and big businessmen who have no experience of utilizing them for productive investment. The bulk of their wealth is squandered in marriages and house building. It is the task of the tax policy of developing country to mobilize the economic surplus, direct it into productive investment and enlarge it. So far we have referred to direct taxes. Now let us take indirect taxes. In underdeveloped countries, indirect taxes occupy a relatively more important position than direct taxes. We have to see how these taxes should be levied so that they not only yield revenue to the state but also encourage investment in economic development program. The question is whether commodities of mass consumption should be taxed or not. It is argued that the incomes of poor people are already very low. Hence, these commodities should not be taxed. But this argument is not valid. Such taxes have great importance for economic development because only by means of these taxes, increase in consumption can be checked as incomes increase and thus saving can be increased, which can be used in economic development. Indirect taxes promote economic development in three ways. A. They check consumption of luxuries and use the saving so made for economic development. B. They mobilize resources for public sector investment and C. They increase the savings ratio. For all the achievement of these objectives, taxation is used for A. Diversion of resources from private to public sector. B. Diversion from consumption goods industries to investment goods industries. And C. Diversion of demand for import goods to export goods. The theory of tax structure development. It is common knowledge that tax structure has undergone changes from time to time. The theory of tax structure seeks to explain changes in tax structure of an economy over time under the impact of economic development and of political and social factors. To take economic development first, tax structure is affected by economic development in three ways. A. Tax base undergoes a change as the developmental process proceeds. B. Change in tax base brings about changes in the revenue system. And C. Economic development leads to changes in the objectives of tax policy. Changes in tax structure under the impact of economic development. Earlier stages of development. In the beginning, we find that these countries are predominantly agricultural and have a slender industrial base. But since agriculturists have low taxable income, it is difficult to reach this sector through income taxation. As regards the industrial sector, since the manufacturing base is thin, the effective tax has to be confined to large-scale establishments. Page number 794. At this stage, the following guidelines are indicated. 1. There should be interlocking of taxes to ensure better tax compliance. That is, a tax on income should be accompanied by expenditure tax and wealth tax. And there should be simultaneously an estate duty and gift tax. 2. There should be a system of fines and penalties for tax evasion and under-reporting. There should be adequate administrative devices to minimize opportunities of tax evasion. Greater emphasis should be put on commodity taxes because they cannot be evaded. New tax bases like foreign trade sector should be tapped. Changes in the later stages of development. As a result of economic development, there are three distinct changes in the tax structure. A. Since the economy becomes monetized, a broader tax base becomes available as large volume of output and income pass through the market. B. There is a wider scope for indirect taxation as consumption and exchange of commodities increases. See, as economic development takes place, there is improvement in the accounting practices of businessmen, making for better assessment of business incomes and taxation. Taxation of incomes becomes more efficient and effective. In spite of these improvements, the tax structure suffers from two serious drawbacks. In the first place, the tax system suffers from the weaknesses of administrative machinery. As the scope for taxation becomes wider, tax collection becomes more complicated. Multiplicity of taxes creates legal and institutional problems from the variety of ways in which incomes are received and outlays made. For instance, estate duty and gift tax gives rise to many technical problems. In the early stages of economic development, the problem was how to assess an elusive herd of cows. But in the later stages, the problem is how to assess an elusive flow of capital. Devices like holding company, trust arrangements, etc. add to the difficulties of the tax administration. As for social and political factors affecting the development of tax structure, we might say that under feudalism, property was an ideal base for taxation. As feudalism gave place to modern capitalism, property as a base for taxation was relegated to the background, and its place was taken by income as a base for taxation. Under a predominantly agricultural economy, land taxes were supreme. But as trade and industry developed, sales and excise duties occupied a pride of place. Under the impact of social philosophy, equity started bothering the taxation authorities. Key terms: tax revenue, non-tax revenue, direct tax, indirect tax, progressive tax, regressive tax, proportional tax, canons of taxation, tax structure, Indian tax system. Questions. 1. Distinguish between progressive and proportional taxation. Examine the limitations of progressive income taxation in an underdeveloped economy. 2. Examine the basic principles of progressive taxation and their impact on saving and investment. 3. What do you mean by progressive taxation? How can it help in ensuring the equitable distribution of national income? 4. Discuss the effects of taxation and public expenditure on the production and distribution with special reference to a developing country. 5. Outline a tax policy designed to promote the economic development of an underdeveloped country. 6. Do you agree that indirect rather than direct taxation will provide large public revenue needed in a developing economy? 7. Discuss the various canons of taxation and explain their importance in a tax system.